Good. Okay, so our purpose is to you understand how X-ray diffraction works, so you'll understand whether we really know whether there are bonds and unshared pairs, these things that Lewis tell us about. And the first thing we need to see is that the X-ray diffraction pattern you get, this bunch of spots, is what's called a convolution. It's sort of a mixture of the molecular pattern, which is what we really want to understand, and the crystal lattice. That's why it's X-ray crystallography. So those two go together in order to give you the X-ray pattern. So last time we did this demonstration, and the first slide we showed with the laser coming through to show interference was a slide with these hexagons standing for benzene, which are all oriented the same way, but are randomly distributed. And if you think about this a little while, which I don't expect you to do, it's not difficult to show that the scattering you get from things that are there arrayed at random is the same as you'd get with just one molecule. Right? So it's as if we're looking at one molecule, but enough of them so that it's bright enough to see. Okay, and that's the pattern we saw, a sort of snowflake. So I want you to understand how it is that having a hexagon of dots generates a snowflake. Okay, so there's the hexagon of dots. And what do we look for to see what direction scattering should be in? We look to see if we can arrange all the dots on a set of parallel lines that are equally spaced from one another. If so, then at a certain angle, all those things will scatter in phase and will get strong reinforcement. And obviously there's such a set of evenly spaced lines in two dimensions or planes in three dimensions, in this case, which is those horizontal lines evenly spaced. Okay, so that will give scattering perpendicular to those lines. That's up and down. Right? And at a certain distance, depends on the wavelength and the distance between the lines, and you worked on that over the weekend or whenever to be able to measure the distance between them by seeing how far apart dots were on the screen. And that gives rise to that spot up there. That particular spot comes from the constructive interference from scattering among those six dots in that particular direction. But of course the thing is six-fold symmetric, so you'll also see these other five. So that explains those patterns. Okay, now they don't have to be precisely on the line, they could just be near a line and still be very nearly in phase, right? So if we look at those yellow lines, those don't pass exactly through any of them, but they're three very close to one and three very close to the other. So we could get constructive interference in that direction. Right, or we could take this, that would give those six with the hexagonal symmetry, or we could take this set of green lines, and that would give reflection in what direction? Where's the spot going to come? What o'clock? What o'clock? 3 or 9, right? I showed 3, but of course it's also 9, and also 1 and 5 and 8 and or 7 and 11, right? Yes. Where's the what? The incoming beam is coming directly toward this pattern. Remember how we set it up? The laser was in the window back there. The slide was in front of it, so it's coming there, and it comes and it hits the screen and gives this pattern. So it comes along, and when it hits the pattern back there, it gets deflected to the left or to the right from this set of planes. Okay, now notice that the green set of planes are much closer than the blue set of planes, so in reciprocal space, the angle is much greater. Right? That's that reciprocal relationship between the spacing of things and the angle at which reflection occurs that surprised us last time. Okay, so closer spaced planes give higher angles. Now, suppose you have the last thing we showed was a slide with a whole bunch of them regularly arrayed, as if in a two-dimensional crystal. Okay, now let's look at the scattering from just one. We just looked at it. It looks like the snowflake. But if it's just one, it's going to be very, very weak. I don't know if we can even see it there. Oh, I need to turn that light off. There we go. Even so, it's difficult to see. Okay, but if we took that, and let's only consider scattering up and down as if it's going through a slit, right? So we'll only see this direction. We'll not worry about right and left scattering. Okay, now of course if we took a whole line of them, they all fall on the same set of horizontal lines, right? So it's going to be just the same, except it's going to be ever so much stronger because it's a whole bunch of them doing it, right? So it'll be brighter, and it'll be that's the scattering from the molecule, the vertical slice of the snowflake. Everybody with me on that? Okay, but if you take the second row as well, then it's brighter also, but now there's interference between the first row and the second row because they don't all fall on exactly the same evenly spaced lines. There's another set of evenly spaced lines for the lower ones, right? So what will that do? That will create bars across the thing. Remember how we saw when there was a vertical pair, we got bars across? So we only see light where both of these patterns agree that there should be light, where the molecule would give light and where that repeat distance would also give light. Right? Now, if there are only two rows, the interference between the rows is slowly varying or smoothly varying. But if you have the whole array of them that goes out forever, remember we saw, you have to have exactly the right angle in order to get interference. If you're just a little bit off with the first one, there'll be another one later on that exactly cancels the first and so on. So you have to be right on the spot. So you just see those dots at those positions. But again, the intensity of those dots at those positions comes from the underlying snowflake, from the molecule. So from the position of the dots, you get what the lattice is. And from the intensity, you get what that underlying pattern from the molecule was, which is what you're after because you're interested in what the structure of the molecule is. So the lattice repeat essentially concentrates the snowflake intensity into tightly focused spots, so they're easier to measure as well. Now, so there's the diffraction, and you see that the strong intensities, like here, and I can't see it, here, and here, and here, and here, and here, are those places where the snowflake was bright. Okay? So the molecular snowflake pattern is viewed, it's as if it were viewed through a pegboard that corresponds to the lattice, and it's amplified to give the same total intensity. Now, I asked, some people don't know what a pegboard is. That's a pegboard that you put on your wall, and you can put little hooks in it and hang tools or whatever. But the thing is, it's got a whole bunch of holes, so it's as if you were holding up that to look at the pattern of the snowflake. Okay, so you have what the real thing, direct, or what's called real space, which is a crystal. And then you have what the X-rays do when they go through it in diffraction space or reciprocal space. They give a photo like this one that von Laue took. Okay? In direct space, you have a unit cell structure. In reciprocal space, you have this fuzzy pattern. In direct space, you have a crystal lattice, a repeating, right? And in the reciprocal space, you have the viewing holes through which to view that pattern. Okay? And notice that if you have decreasing spacing in real space, that corresponds to increasing spacing in reciprocal space, which is, of course, why it's called reciprocal. Okay? Are there any questions about this? Yeah? In terms of what?
X-ray diffraction of a molecule.
Yep. Remember, it's X-ray diffraction of a crystal, which is a set of molecules, but go ahead.
So if you were to do it then, because they were so close, would the spacing be very, very far apart? Or apart, really?
Yeah, except that the X-rays are very, very short. The closer things are together, the bigger the angle of scattering. But that depends on the wavelength of the light, and that's why you use X-rays. They're so very short. If you tried to use visible light, forget it.
Sure. Yeah.
Sharif?
Could you explain what you meant by decreasing spacing?
Yeah, if atoms are closer together in real space, it corresponds to things being further apart. Or if the crystal lattice has a bigger spacing in real space, it means the spots are closer together in reciprocal space. Any other questions? Okay, so then the last thing we showed was a light bulb filament. And it gave this kind of pattern. And again, we can analyze it to see why it gives this X with dots along the branch of the X. And as I mentioned, this vertical line and the horizontal line have nothing to do with the helix. Those are because the helix is in a frame that's rectangular. It generates those lines. So don't worry about those. Just worry about the X. Okay, so you have, there's a lot more density of metal in this case on these lines than there is on any other line, say, in between them, because one that's in between here only goes through the cross section of a little bit of the wire, but this one has a whole lot of the wire on it. Okay, so there's lots and lots of the wire on that set of parallel planes compared to what's, say, halfway between them. Okay, so that will give scattering in this direction and give this first spot. Now, if we took another set of or up to the left or down to the right, if we took a set of planes half that spacing, where would it come in reciprocal space? It would be twice as far out, roughly. There's a sign involved, but it's twice as far out, right? And along the same direction. So that gives this line out, that spot out there. Okay, and so on and so on. You could have lines still closer together, parallel lines. Or you can do it down to the right, or you can do it up to the right and down to the left as well. So it gives an X, and it's a dot. Now, the X tells you how tightly the helix is wound. You know what a slinky is? You've played with a slinky. If you had the slinky compressed, the successive things are like this, right? And the ones going the other way are like this. But if you stretch the slinky out, it would go like that. Right? So the angle of the X tells you what the pitch of the helix is. Right? The flatter the helix, the more scrunched the helix, the sharper the X is. Okay, that's obvious. Okay, now, what does the spot spacing tell you? The angle of the X tells you how tightly it's wound. What does the spot spacing tell you? Derek? Right, it tells you how close one is to the next. The spacing in real space gives you the spacing in reciprocal space. So it tells what the scale. The first thing tells you the shape, how tightly it's wound, but then what's the scale, right? The distance. Actual distance comes from that, the spacing of the spots. If you know the wavelength and the distance from the slide to the screen, that's the problem you worked on. Okay, and notice that the spots weaken successfully. It's the first one's strong, the next one's weaker, the next one's weaker, the next one's very, very weak. And the reason for that is that the helix, that the material the stuff is made out of, isn't infinitely thin. So if you start getting planes that are very close together, within a given part of the wire, some is on the line and some is a little bit away from it and interfering. And the closer you space those lines together, the higher fraction of the metal is not exactly on the line or really near the line, so it'll be interfere. So that's why they get weaker as they go out. Now, I only mention that because what Rosalind Franklin saw in BDNA is different. Notice that she has the helix, and you can tell how tightly it's wound from the angle of the helix. But if you look at the intensities, they don't go strong, a little bit less strong, weaker, 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 weaker as you go out. The first one is weak, the next one's strong, the next one is also pretty strong, but the next one is very weak, and the next one is strong again, relatively strong. So this is a funny sequence of intensities. It doesn't just get weaker as you go out because of the finite size. Now, why is that? We saw last time this... let's see, what's the story here? Yeah. Oh, here. this thing here, right, where you start there, then you get this one is strong. Then the one which for the first and the third here would be strong is for the interleaving one very weak. The interleaving one cancels the first one, right? And the fourth would cancel the fourth would cancel the third and blah blah or whatever it is. Okay. So we saw it would go, if we had just the first and the last, we get bing 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 bing. Right? But if we put one in between, we get no bing, bing, no bing, bing, right? The intervening one cancels it if you have a really long row of these things. Now, what would happen if they weren't evenly spaced, if they were like this? So consider the first and the third where we have it bing, 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 okay? But what if we have one that's in between, but not halfway in between? Right? Now, when we get to the first one, it's weakened, but not exactly canceled by the second interleaved one. You got that? It's weakened, but not canceled. Now we go to this one, and again, that one is now strengthened by the intervening one, but not quite as much as it could be. If we go to the third, it's still strengthened. So it went weak, strong, strong, instead of nothing, strong, nothing, strong. Right? And if we go to the next one, now what is it? Almost completely canceled. Very weak. And how about the next one? Very strong. So it went weak, strong, strong, very weak, strong, which is what she got. Right? So what did this show, the sequence of intensities about her helix? Yeah. It's a double helix, but the middle, the second helix is not halfway along the first one. Let's look at it here. Okay, so there's one helix. We've got this set of planes, right? And we put a double helix with a set of planes that's exactly interleaved, right? And what that will, the planes then would be twice as close together, and so the spots would be twice as far apart. Every other one would be canceled. But if you have an offset double helix like this, then it's as if you were repeating a pair pattern. And remember, we talked about repeating a pair pattern of dots, and we saw that you got a modulated set line, and that's exactly what you have here in DNA. There's a major groove and a minor groove. And Crick saw that immediately when he looked at the X-ray, because he'd been dealing with diffraction of protein helices, so he knew what he was looking for. Brian?
This is for two slides back, but what is this Fox Mason tell us? The scale of...
But did you do the problem where I said, figure out, if you know the dots are 10.8 centimeters apart and you know the distance to the back of the room and the wavelength of the light, then you know how close the lines are on the slide. It's the same thing here. If you know the angle, that is the distance and how far out the dots are, and what the wavelength of the light is, you can tell how far apart these successive turns of the helix are. It's the same kind of measurement. Got it now? Good. Okay. Notice there's of course, it's not exactly like a light bulb filament, but notice that there's much more, these things that have phosphorus and a lot of oxygen here have a lot of electrons. So there's a lot of electrons near this plane, but there are not many electrons near a plane halfway between those. Right? Okay, but notice also that if you look down on the top of the cylinder, just sighted through it, you'd see a lot of phosphorus here and a lot of phosphorus here, but not so many phosphorus and oxygens in the middle. What direction would that, would lots of density at that, in that direction, what o'clock would that scatter? 3 and 9, right? And depending on how far apart they are, the spots would be a certain distance out. And that's what you see here and here. on her spots. That tells you how big around the cylinder is. Okay, and those things are what are the direction of the planes that are causing scattering up and down? Horizontal planes will cause scattering up and down. How far apart are those planes compared to the other things we're talking about? They're really close together to give scattering that's very far apart. So this is the stacking of the aromatic bases, right? Along the thing. So you see all this stuff, if you know what you're looking for, right in that pattern. Now this wasn't a crystal, but the molecules were all oriented properly by they're really long molecules, and if you stretch it, you get the long axis to line up. So it wasn't a crystal, but the molecules were aligned, but randomly aligned. They weren't all exactly either parallel or evenly spaced. So it's like that first slide where they're all oriented the same way, but not regularly spaced. So it's not a lattice. Okay, so knowing a molecule's electron density, it's pretty straightforward to know what the diffraction pattern is going to look like. And we even worked backwards, sort of, here, although we knew it was a helix, right? So if you use, going the other direction is tough, but there's heavy-duty math that earned people a well-deserved Nobel Prize, but now you don't have to get a Nobel Prize anymore. All you have to do is press a button on the computer that has this algorithm in it, right? And you go, and you can go the other way. Start with the intensities and get back to what the molecule looks like or what the electrons look like. Why don't you see the nuclei? Why do you see electrons and not nuclei with X-ray? Sinead? What do you mean big? Like this? They're too massive. They're too heavy. So they don't vibrate and generate. They don't act as antennas. But the electrons do. Okay, so then you go, in the olden days, what you'd do is take a computer and you'd print out a sheet of paper and consider yourself lucky that you had these numbers that showed the electron density on a particular plane in three dimensions. And then you'd make another sheet that would be the next plane, and another sheet that would be the next plane, and another sheet that would be the next plane. And we'd have these numbers that say what the electron density, the relative electron density is here and here and here and here and here. And then you take a pen and you connect places of the same value and make a contour, right? And that's what was done here. So you can see a slice through the molecule or through the crystal and what the electron density is profiled on that slice. Now, that slice could go any old direction. So it might go through the center of an atom, or it might just barely graze an atom. Okay? So what you see here, where there are lots and lots of contours, is that cut very near the nucleus of that particular atom where there's a lot of electrons, right? But this one was just a glancing cut, so it didn't get many of the electrons on that particular atom. Fortunately, this particular molecule that was in question here, I was going to show you another one. This is potassium salt of penicillin. So this is where they determined the structure of penicillin in 1949. And they plotted it on sheets of acrylic, right? So they could then stack them up and see a three-dimensional picture of the electron density. Now, you can see the atoms there, right? Which one is the potassium atom? Yeah, Victor, pardon me? What do I mean by what? Well, we're trying to plot density in three dimensions, right? Here's the molecule in three dimensions. We want to plot the electron density. But there's no way to do that. What we can do with paper is slice through a particular slice of it and see what the density is at all those points and make one of these plots. And then we can slice at a different altitude and see all those. And here they're stacked up. So we can now see it in three dimensions with contour for the electron density.
Areas of similar electron density.
Of the same electron density. So it's like a map of atmospheric pressure or temperature. Yeah.
So would the penicillin then be the more...
Not the penicillin.
Oh.
Would the what be? The potassium.
The potassium would then be the ones without the... That's not as densely circled.
What's the... You're on the right. You have the idea, but it's a little backwards. Henry? potassium has an enormous number of electrons compared to any of the other atoms in here. So it'll have many, many more contours of electron density. So which is it? This one. Or this one from the next unit cell. Okay? Yeah. No, you calculate it. The computer can calculate this number from the intensities using this fancy math and so on. It can calculate the density at any given point. Okay? So you know the electron density at all points. The problem is to make a picture of it. So the way to make a picture is to look at just one level and see what the numbers are on that level. And then in order to add the third Z dimension, you take another level and another and another, and that's what this map is. Yeah, Brian?
What are the areas between the two?
It's where there aren't any electrons. Or not as many electrons as there are where the contours are. Okay? Okay. Nowadays, nobody does this anymore. You look at it on a computer screen. But this helps you see what really goes on. Okay, now, this molecule ribofuserin has the advantage that it's planar. What's great about that for our purposes? Jordan? Yeah, because now we can slice through all the things and we don't have to do all the other slices. Okay, so there's a slice through the nuclei. Now, and it's contoured at 1 electron per cubic angstrom. So here the density is 1 electron per cubic angstrom, 2, 3, 4, 5. So at the middle it's between 5 and 6 electrons per cubic angstrom, the density at that nucleus. Okay? Or near that nucleus. Now, so there it's 5 electrons per cubic angstrom. But there, it's 7 electrons per cubic angstrom. Why? Why are they different?
I kind of had a question.
Yeah, what's the question?
Didn't you say before that the electrons were like really far outside the nucleus,
I said the size of the nucleus is 10 to the fifth of the size of the electron cloud. Right? So the nucleus is right down in the middle. How do you know where the nucleus is? You know, those lines are drawn to connect the atoms, by which we mean to connect the nuclei, because the electrons are in a cloud. Okay, how do you know where the nuclei are? If you can't see the nuclei, all you can see is the electron density.
Why is the electron density the highest in the middle?
Where did you get that? How do you know there's no electron there? What does the map? What do you infer from the map? That the electrons are mostly at the nucleus. That's the highest density, is what you see in the map. And how do you know where the nuclei are? Dan? How do you know where the nuclei are? Yeah. Don? It's the center of the circle, right? It looks the atoms look like balls, like onions, with higher and higher density as you get closer to the nucleus. So if you know where the electron density is highest, that's where the nucleus is. Okay, now how come one is, well, this is 5 and this one is 7? Why are some bigger than others? Dennis, you got an idea? Would all atoms have the same electron density? Why not? Can't hear. What?
They're not the same.
They're not the same atom, right? And in fact, those red ones are all 7 in the middle, but the others are not that big because ribofuserin has 5 oxygens in it. So you can tell which ones are oxygens by having higher density. Okay? Now, what else can you tell? Now, bonds are drawn in there, but those are just lines drawn. The X-ray didn't tell you that. You just connected the centers of these things. How do you know what's a single, double, triple bond? The distances are different for single, double, and triple. Right? Oh, incidentally, there are no H's in there. I meant to mention that. Why no H's? Yeah. Pardon me?
Hydrogen only has 1 electron,
and it's very diffuse, right? So you don't even see it. No electrons there. Okay, but those are different in length, and long, short, and intermediate. So they're single, double, and intermediate. Why intermediate? because you can have that structure and also that calculated structure. They're 1.5 bonds. It's resonance. Okay? But notice the key lesson here for our purposes is that what the electrons are is as if it was just spherical atoms. We're not seeing electrons between. There are no bonds. The electrons aren't gathered in the middle as a pair of dots. Right? It just looks like atoms. Right? And there's no unshared pairs on the oxygens sticking out. It's just spherical atoms. Robin?
Is the only reason you know that one is representing oxygen versus carbon is you know in advance what the compound is made of?
Actually, people did know that and it helped. But even if they didn't know it, they would know it from how much electron density there was there. There's more electrons for oxygen than there is for a carbon. Yeah?
You say you can't see the bonds or anything in the picture before with the passing
Yeah?
There's like a suggestion of like where the bonds might be with some of the lines?
Well, if you go to low enough contours, you know, you have, they're separate. At some point, they begin to form figure eights because they are peanut shapes because they overlap. You might think that looks like a bond, but all it is spherical atoms overlapping, maybe.
You said that due to the resonance rupture, the bond has to, instead of being 1 or 2, between 1.5.
Yeah, between 1 and 2.
So if we were to, like, do X-ray crystallography over time, would we see the bond length?
Ah, no. Why not? Why would, if you can't do X-ray that quickly as fast as atoms vibrate. But if you could, would you see sometimes it would be a single and sometimes it would be a double? What? It's a single minimum. It's not a double minimum where it goes back and forth. It sits in the middle. Right? It's resonance. It's not equilibrium. Okay. So, we don't see bonds in this picture. Is there a way to see bonds? Yes, there is. And you do it with what's called difference density maps, or sometimes they're called deformation density. It's how much the electrons get deformed when you form a bond. The isolated atoms are spherical. Right? When they're in a molecule, they look spherical, as we just saw. But are they exactly spherical, or have they been deformed a little bit? How could you make a plot that would show how much they've been deformed from being spheres? That is, you have the experimentally the true electron density, the total electron density, and you know what it would be like if it's just spheres. Right? You can calculate that for what isolated atoms would be if they were in those positions. How do you see, how do you make a plot, a map, that shows that the experimental one is not just spheres? Henry? You could superimpose them and see if they're little lumps. But they're, pardon me, go ahead. So you could color where one contour goes a little bit further out than the other or something like that, or where it comes a little bit further in. You could color it red and green. That would be a reasonable way of doing it, but there's a fancier way of doing it. Mike?
Subtract
one from the other and plot the difference. That's what a difference density map is. This will show you to what extent the true electron density departs from being really spherical, from being just atoms. Okay, so you take the observed electron density and subtract what you calculate it would be if it were just atoms. Okay, so here's a good example of that. This molecule that had four double bonds in a row and benzenes on the terminal carbons. This was done by Ziva Berkovich-Yellen and Les Lazarovich long time ago, 34 years ago. So let's first look at the map of the benzene ring. So there are the six carbons of the benzene ring, the hexagonal benzene ring, but we've subtracted out the carbon atoms. We've taken the total electron density and subtracted out what you'd have if it was just carbon atoms. We didn't subtract the hydrogens, right? So you see there's a lot of contours here. There's a lot of density where the hydrogens would be. So this was work that was done very, very carefully to get very precise numbers. So when you subtract, you don't just get garbage, right? You get something that's significant. Okay, so there's a hydrogen which wasn't subtracted, and you see the electron density associated with that. And if you integrate how much electron density is within that area, it's one electron, the electron of the hydrogen. Okay, if you, but here, but there's nothing here. That's where the carbon should be. The carbon should be most intense at its center here. But between this carbon and this carbon on the single bond, if you go halfway between and integrate there, you get that there's 0.1 electron more there than there would be if you just had two carbon atoms at those positions. So electron density has a little bit concentrated at that position. How much would you expect it to be if it were a Lewis? If Lewis structure, if there were a pair of electrons right halfway between. Kevin? It'd be two electrons. It's 0.1. Now that's a little bit exaggerated to say that it's only 1/20th as big, because if you just had the two atoms, you'd already have some electron density there. But what we see is that the shift due to bonding is just 1/20th of a Lewis. Okay? And in those aromatic, the bonds, carbon-carbon bonds that are 1.5 bonds, there are 0.2 electrons in those. Right? And if we take a cross-section of that bond and rotate it to look at the cross-section, it's round. No big surprise there. But if you take a cross-section of one of these in the ring and rotate it, it's oval. Why is the bond not round? Henry? Can't hear. Ah, it has pi bond as well as sigma, right? That tends to distort it out like that. Okay, we'll talk more about that later. Now, if we look not at the benzene rings that are out on the edge, but at those three double bonds in a row that are in the middle. Okay, there's that bond we already looked at, the carbon-carbon bond. But here's a double carbon-carbon double bond. And there's a carbon-carbon double bond in the middle, and it has even a little bit more electron density. Extra electron density, deformation density, difference density, density due to the bond, extra density due to the bond. If we slice that one, we see that there was a double bond, pi contribution in and out of the plane, like that. Right? But if you slice the center one and rotate it the same way, it's also oval, but it's oval in the other direction, 90 degrees. So that one is a horizontal double bond. And the next one is vertical again. You knew that already by symmetry. Okay, but why isn't there any electron density where those two blue things come together? Why is it not round or clover leaf when you slice through the middle? Right? We'll address that later when we get to quantum mechanics. Okay, but notice that it's as if there were bent bonds from tetrahedral carbon. So there's extra density up here, that's here and here, and extra density out here, that's here and here, right? But not extra density here and here. Isn't that interesting? Now, how many electrons are there in a bond? Well, we can make a plot. Here's the distance of a bond. This is a single bond, double bond. Well, here's a single bond, double bond, triple bond. And there is a 1.5 bond, the one in a benzene ring. And if we did Lewis bookkeeping, there'd be 2 electrons in a single bond, 3 in a 1.5 bond, 4 in a double bond, and 6 in a triple bond. Everybody with me on that? That's how many dots you'd draw. Okay? Now, in this thing that we just looked at, we had double bonds and aromatic bonds and single bonds, and that's the amount of electron difference density there is. It looks really good, right? It really fits well, except that the scale, and they did a number of other molecules as well, except the scale is 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, not 2, 4, 6. Right, so it's very subtle. If you use X-ray to look at a molecule, what you see is atoms. But if you look really carefully, do really good experiments, and look really carefully and subtract what the atoms would be if they were truly spherical, you see these things that are about as 20th as big as what you might predict using Lewis structures. Yeah.
Structures exaggerate the level of sharing.
Yeah. So bonding density is about 1/20th of a Lewis. Incidentally, if you mention Lewis anyplace outside this class, no one will know what the heck you're talking about. We're the only people who use the unit Lewis for two electrons. Density, yes. Ah, that'll be very interesting. What would you expect to see in an ionic bond? You'd expect to see extra electron density on the anion and a deficit of electron density on the cation. So it's going to be interesting to see, which we'll do later on, whether that really is true, whether bonds really are ionic. But you're not going to be surprised to hear that often the amount of ionicity isn't as big as you thought it was going to be, if bonds aren't as big as you thought they were going to be. And sometimes it is big. We'll see. Okay, so here's a molecule that's very symmetrical and very, very possible to, and possible if you have Swiss people working on you. These people live all in Zurich, and you know their grandfathers were watchmakers and things like that, and they do very, very precise work. If you do, this is something where you can do really, really great high precision work. Okay, so we have that, and that part of the molecule is unique. The rest is related by symmetry, but they showed a window that's a little bit bigger than just the unique part. And there's the map they got. This is the electron difference density they found for that particular molecule. So it's got single and aromatic bonds and triple bonds and other things that you'll see. Okay, so first, here's an aromatic bond, and we slice and turn it and see that it's the way you expect it to be. And here's another one, and we slice and turn it, and that's the way you expect it to be. It's the same as the other one, right? It's not single, double, it's all 1.5 bonds. And now you slice through that single bond and turn it. What's it going to look like cross-section? Oval, round, square? Sunwa? What will it look like? A single bond when you slice through it. Yes, cylindrical, right, or round in this cross section. Okay, so that's fine. And now we'll cut through a triple bond. And we're going to see what it looks like. Sinead, what do you think? Like an X? Yeah, it might look like that, right? Because it's two double bonds. Here's what it really looks like, Sinead. It's round. It's not cloverleaf, and it's not a diamond. It's round. That's a little surprising, isn't it? We'll get on to that. Okay? What's that thing? There's no bond there. Why do you get difference density there? Pardon me? There's an unshared pair on the nitrogen. You can actually see it. Okay, now what's this thing? So that's the unshared pair. What's this? Jonathan, what do you think that is? What should it be? We're looking at bonds and unshared pairs. What should that be? Well, there might be unshared pairs on the fluorine, but that's not where they would be. In the region that I've circled, what should you see? Electrons, yeah, in the carbon-fluorine bond. What do you see? Almost nothing. Where's the carbon-fluorine bond? You can see all the other bonds quite well. Okay, now this brings us to the second key question in the course. And for some reason I can't understand, the sound isn't working on this. This is from the Beiderbecke affair, which is a really good movie that you should see sometime. And it's supposed to have sound on it, but I think it's not going to work because I just tried it at the start of class. So these three guys are plotting to catch their superior in the police department in Yorkshire, who's a crooked cop, right? And he comes in and finds them standing there. So what are we talking about? Well, we're talking about community policing, sir. Sergeant Hobson is telling us about community policing. And so we paused in our work to do this. So he says, and what are you going to do next? Discuss the early novels of Thomas Hardy, the race card at Pontefract, the theory of relativity? Catch some thieves, Hobson. That's what we're here for. So Hobson clicks his heels and walks away down the hall. Click, 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 click. And the crooked cop says to these other guys, "What do you think of him?" And they say, "Compared with what, sir?" "Exactly." So that's it. What do you think of him? "Compared with what, sir?" "Exactly." That's the second question. What's the first question? How do you know? And the second one is, compared with what? And that's the problem in doing this subtraction. You're comparing the experimental stuff with what you would expect if there weren't bonds. Okay, now, what do you expect if there... That's what you're subtracting, compared with what? Now, we've seen this before when we talked about there being special stabilization due to resonance, that the energy of the molecule is low. What do you wonder? Compared to what is it low? Right? It's compared to what you would expect if you only had one Lewis structure, and you have to have some way of knowing what that expectation is in order to see that resonance contributes stability. Or in this case, when you're talking about difference electron density, you're comparing the observed total electron density with the sum of the electron densities for a set of undistorted atoms. But the question is, what's an undistorted fluorine atom? Okay. Now, you might say that an undistorted fluorine atom is spherical, right? But it turns out that that creates a problem because fluorine has all but one of its eight possible electrons, which means it has 1¾ electrons in each quadrant around it. Right? If you were then to mix that with an electron, bonding electron from carbon, you'd get 2.75 in that region. But the Pauli principle will not allow you to have more than 2. So that's not the way fluorine is when it's going to be making a bond. It has to contribute only 1 electron to this, and carbon 1. Right? So this is what you should really be subtracting, as a fluorine ready to make a bond. And obviously, if you subtract less, you'll get more stuff there. And that's why when you have extra electron pairs around, when you have an atom that has many extra electrons, more than 4, then these pictures look a little funny, because it's compared to what? You're comparing it to something that's impossibility because of the Pauli principle, which I'm asserting to you, not proving to you. Okay? Okay, now... here's Dunitz again, and with his collaborators doing really high precision work, got these dimensions. These are the bond distances are within 2/1000th of an angstrom, right? So this was done very carefully, but those are only for the distance between the average positions of the atoms, because actually the atoms are vibrating by 25 times that much, right? And in fact, that's this just shows how precise they were. Because if we look at this carbon atom here and see how big that vibration is, it's that big. That's how much they're vibrating, right? And they measured it at 95 Kelvin in order to minimize the vibration and get the best possible data to measure what they really wanted to measure about that. So bear in mind that the atoms are always moving, but they're not moving very much, only that much within that circle. Okay, now, because the reason he studied it was because this is a case of pathological bonding. So I'll just start this and not get to the pathology. So there's the skeleton of the molecule, and now you can make, it's not all planar, so you can slice it different ways and see different things. And today we'll look at this slice, which goes through the benzene ring and a few other atoms. And it looks like that, and we're looking at the difference density. And there's nothing surprising here. It's only that it's really beautiful. You see all the carbon-hydrogen bonds, right? The carbon-carbon bonds that are aromatic, right? 1½ bonds, and carbon-carbon bonds that are single bonds, and these carbon-carbon bonds going out here. So it's really good data. But what we're going to see next time is that if you slice it different ways, you see really weird bonds. And that's what we want to understand. So we'll see that next time. Forgot to time it. I have to do it again.
When you showed the cross sections and you cut it and you showed the circles, which direction was that? I didn't quite understand.
Which direction was it sliced?
Yeah. For example, like let's say you have one of these.
Right, well, like this one, the one we just looked at here, this one. The pink plane is the slice. Mm-hmm. Right, and then that's a picture of what the difference density looks like on that slice.
I see. What about when we I understand that. What about when we have one of these and then we said, okay, we're going to slice it?
Okay, then we slice it a different direction perpendicular to the bond and see what the cross section of the bond looks like.
Okay, I gotcha. Okay.
Will we ever need to, are you ever going to give us a molecule and require us to construct an extra diffraction pattern from it?
Not any more complicated than what we just did here.
Okay.
That's not the main point of the course.
But as long as we generally understand the principles.
Yeah, that's the idea.
I have Arabic in the morning,
and
we just moved to a classroom really far away.
Yeah.
So she let us out early today, so I was able to make it on time, but I don't know if I'll be able to make it.
I'll make it when you can.
Is that okay? Is it a problem?
Yeah, well, I mean, you either miss some of that or some of this, so I'm not offended.
Okay.
Yeah, I just had a question about the last fluorine, I was just wondering, I was kind of confused on that part. Like, so we were saying, like, you're subtracting, like fluorine, how normally...
You're subtracting a spherical fluorine atom.
Yeah.
But if you put a spherical fluorine atom next to a carbon, you'd already have too many electrons in the region of the bond. The Pauli principle, which we haven't discussed, wouldn't allow that.
Okay.
So that's not realistic.
Oh, okay.
And if you want to see more about it, you can go to the website, and there's a movie of Dunnett's talking about this.
Okay.
So you can hear it from the horse's mouth.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, that's the one thing I didn't understand, too. So. It's just because as soon as it gets there, it's not.
Yeah, here I'll show you. I don't know why the sound didn't work on this. I got to figure that out. But if we go to... this is that paper we were just talking about. So if you go here, it's not. I don't hear the sound now either. Oh, it's over there. It's that.
Ultimate evidence is electron density difference matters. One of the best examples is the general fluoro diazion events, which we'll talk about. But